Hello, New Covenant. This is Sharon Chubbuck from Milwaukee. I am very delighted to be with you today in person and virtually on this first Sunday of Lent. I have to say I like the Greek Orthodox approach to Lent. They clean their houses, they confess their sins, they fast and pray and those things, but they call it a time of bright sadness, a time when the flower of repentance is beginning to bloom. It's a sober but hopeful time. And so I'm glad to be here to share this first Sunday of Lent with you. As I thought about the teaching today, I had a memory of what I call one of my mental photo albums, where I store mental snapshots of the events of my life that have been really significant in one way or another. And I want to share one of those with you now. I grew up during the Cold War. The year I was 10, the Berlin Wall was built. The nuclear arms race between America and the Soviet Union was raging. Khrushchev, leader of the Soviet Union, pounded his shoe on the UN table, shouting, "We will bury you," or so they say. Now, I'm not sure how I knew all these things. Maybe I heard the news at 5 o'clock with Walter Cronkite. Maybe I heard my parents talking. I don't know. I just know that it was a tense time in the nation, and I was scared, very scared. I remember the nuclear attack drills at school, sitting against the lockers, knees pulled up to our chest, heads down, covered with our arms. We laugh about that now, but at the time it felt deadly serious. I remember begging my dad to build us a bomb shelter in the backyard, but he didn't listen to me. And then the Cuban Missile Crisis happened. For those of you who may not be familiar with it, it was a standoff between the United States and the Soviet Union. The United States having placed nuclear missile sites in Italy and Turkey that could reach the USSR, and the Soviet Union putting their own missile sites in Cuba, just 90 miles from the United States mainland. It was a tense moment. They resolved it, both sides backed down, and the world went on. But there are historians who say it was the closest moment to full-scale nuclear war that the world had ever seen. So my snapshot was of one night in particular in the middle of that crisis, when the threat of war seemed suffocatingly real. I was terrified. I was sure that nuclear missiles would be launched probably that night, and my dad hadn't built that bomb shelter for our family. I told my mom how scared I was. Now, I don't remember her saying much about the Soviet Union or nuclear missiles. Instead, she said, "Come into the living room. I have something I want to show you." And my mom was a wonderful musician with a big, beautiful organ in the living room. She sat me down beside her on the organ bench, and she then played a wonderful old hymn recorded by Mahalia Jackson and Ethel Waters, "His Eye is on the Sparrow, and I Know He Watches Me." She played it, we talked about the words, and then she taught me to play it, and we sang it together. "His eye is on the sparrow, and I know he watches me." And as we sang, and as we heard those words, my heart calmed down. I don't distinctly remember ever thinking that I could be confident the crisis would end well just because God was watching over us, but I do remember feeling incredibly safe and at peace because God was present with us, with love for us. That snapshot is really vivid for me, and I think of that moment and that song often over the years. Well, now here we are today, at a point in time that's also pretty tense, anxious, even overwhelming at times. We each have our own personal griefs, losses, pain, and now nationally and globally, the 2 years of COVID with its suffering, death, and the deep inequities that have been exposed even more. A deadly climate crisis that seems to be accelerating, a nation divided by political hatred and distrust, racism and racial inequity, never really gone, is now publicly expressed to a degree we thought we had eliminated. And now war in Ukraine, with nuclear saber rattling and the threat of autocracy growing. Each picture of bombarded Ukrainian cities, of death and destruction and refugees fleeing, is painful. And each one reminds us of all the violence and suffering happening around the world for so long. We grieve for those who are suffering, and we feel anxiety for ourselves over what the future may hold. At least I do. It's sobering. And the question that stands out to me, how can we be God's people in a world where fear seems more reasonable than faith? Here's another snapshot. Decades ago, I picked up a book. I don't remember anything about it, author, title, content, except the preface, where the author was described as one of those rare people who can look at the world unflinchingly, seeing all the grittiness, pain, suffering, violence, loss, not deny or ignore any of it, and still keep faith in the goodness of God. To see the world clear-eyed and still have faith in the goodness of God. I thought then, and I think now, that is the kind of person I want to be. To see the world with clear eyes and still keep faith in the goodness of God. Full disclosure, I have really had trouble being that kind of person all my life. But it seems like that is the question that we face. How to see the gritty reality of the world around us and not be swallowed up by fear and despair. How do we keep faith and remember who we are and who God is? And that question brings us to Psalm 27. Let's look at the psalm with our imaginations. I ask you to try and see through the eyes of David before he became king, probably written while he was being hunted down by King Saul and his men. They hid out in caves. They had to beg for food. They engaged in skirmishes. They ran for their lives. Try to picture it and see if we can imagine his emotions, his thoughts, even how his body was positioned. Try to put yourselves in David's shoes and let us see what God has to say to us. Verse 1. I picture this at the beginning of the day as the sun is rising. David looks out at the beauty. He's well rested. He feels exultant. He feels full of bold confidence and trust in God. The Lord is my light and my salvation. Whom shall I fear? The Lord is the stronghold of my life. Of whom shall I be afraid? Powerful, positive words of faith. Light to guide in the darkness. Salvation to rescue from danger. And a fortress to protect from attack. David is confident. He doesn't have anything to be afraid of. And yet, this claim, this confidence, is spoken in the midst of implied dangers. We need the light because we live in darkness. We need rescue because we are threatened. We need a fortress because we are under attack. Darkness, threat, attack. And David stands here shouting, feeling the emotion of his confidence, his faith, not even mentioning the implied threats. Can you hear his voice? Can you see his face? Can you see how he's standing when he says this? Let your imaginations dwell on it for a moment. And then we come to verse 2 and 3, and the tone shifts. And this one I like to imagine that maybe it's mid-morning. Saul and his men are getting close. David and his men are running, looking for a different place to hide. And the sun is hot. He's getting hungry. His head hurts. Imagine the tone of voice as he speaks these words and the emotions that he's feeling. When the wicked advance against me to devour me, it is my enemies and my foes who will stumble and fall. Though an army besiege me, my heart will not fear. Though war break out against me, even then I will be confident. Now this time, the dangers are not implied. They are stated plainly and graphically. My enemy's going to eat me alive, and they are ready to attack the troops and tanks all around. An entire war is breaking out against me and my family, my people. What seemed like a slam dunk triumph of faith in early morning is not so simple now. There are a lot of reasons for fear. And David is taking a clear-eyed look at the threats of the world this time. Does his voice change any? Can maybe hear an edge of anxiety? But David makes a decision to trust God in the midst of all these things, in the midst of them. He chooses to trust in God's protection, even though his emotions may not quite match up to his words. What may have been a spontaneous shout of confidence at sunrise is now an intentional decision to trust right in the middle of real terror, to have faith in the face of genuine fears. And David chooses to trust. But now he has a little better understanding of how dangerous the situation actually is, a clearer vision of exactly why he needs God's salvation and rescue. I would imagine you can hear that in his voice. And then we come to verse 4, 5, and 6, and we see a really big shift. As I imagine it, maybe it's nighttime. The day has been harrowing. David is exhausted. And now he's staring into the fire, reflecting, pausing, trying to catch his breath. And he's thinking, you know, the truth is, one thing I ask from the Lord, this only do I seek, that I may dwell in the house of the Lord all the days of my life, to gaze on the beauty of the Lord and to seek him in his temple. For in the day of trouble, he will keep me safe in his dwelling. He will hide me in the shelter of his sacred tent and set me high upon a rock. Then my head will be exalted above the enemies who surround me. At his sacred tent, I will sacrifice with shouts of joy. I will sing and make music to the Lord. The world David's in is still dangerous. The next day will bring more trouble. But right now, David's vision is clearing. He's retreating to the house of the Lord, even as he sits around the fire. And in the grand scheme of things, he sees only you matter, Lord. Only being with you, only loving you and being loved by you. It seems the grittier life becomes, the more David's priorities become clear. You, Lord, are the answer to the longings of my soul. You are the answer to the hopes and fears of the entire world throughout all time. Here's another snapshot I'll share with you. 10 years ago, I was diagnosed with breast cancer and went through treatment, and happy to say I am now cancer-free. But a few years before that diagnosis, I had a mammogram where they just couldn't quite tell. So they told me to come back for another one. It created such an intense level of fear as I'd never felt before. And I had to wait 3 days to learn anything. As those 3 days passed and that fear continued to surge through me, I remember the thought that kept popping into my mind. I just want to be with you. Whatever happens, I want to be with you. I was scared out of my mind, but at some deep level, I realized that only one thing mattered, to be with the Lord. And I wanted that one thing. Years later, when the diagnosis was real, I was even more scared out of my mind, and I had to learn the lesson all over again. One thing matters more than anything else. You, Lord. I like to think about David's voice saying these words as he reflected on the hardships of the day and looked inward. Did he take a deep breath? I imagine his voice was low and calm. The truth is, there's really only one thing I want. I want you, Lord. Now, it's important to realize here, David isn't saying he won't return to real life. This isn't religious escapism. It's a retreat to regroup. And he's refocusing his heart. He's remembering who he is and who God is. Then we come to verse 7 through 12. Something has happened. David is feeling real fear. He is facing increased danger. Maybe it's an attack in the middle of the night that woke them up. Maybe Saul and his men are storming the cave where the men are sleeping and they're startled out of their dreams. Whatever it is, the grittiness of life has swept back in and fear has taken David by surprise. And he cries out, "Hear my cry, hear my voice when I call, Lord. Be merciful to me and answer me. My heart says of you, seek his face. Your face, Lord, I will seek. Do not hide your face from me. Do not turn your servant away in anger. You've been my helper. Do not reject me or forsake me, God, my Savior. Though my mother and father forsake me, the Lord will receive me. Teach me your way, Lord. Lead me in a path that's straight because of my oppressors. Do not turn me over to the desires of my foes, for false witnesses rise up against me, spouting malicious accusations." Wow. Life is hammering down on David, and he is scared. In this section, he speaks directly to God for the first time in the psalm, "Don't leave me." He still expresses his trust, but the fears keep crowding back in. "The Lord will take care of me, even if my family abandons me." But right then back to Christ, "Don't turn me over to my enemies." Can you hear his voice? Can you see his face? Understand the emotions, the panic and fear he's feeling, the struggle to keep trusting? Can you picture how David is standing as he cries out for help? Well, let's trace the progression of this psalm. There's a story arc. David starts confident in his trust and shouts praise to God. But he grows more and more aware of the real dangers he's facing. He then finds renewed comfort and refreshment by being with God. And then, bam, he is hit with even more panic and doubt, and he struggles to keep faith. Does that cycle sound familiar? It does to me. It's the stuff of my life. Which brings us to verse 13 and 14. And for me, this is the statement that pulls the entire psalm together. "I remain confident of this. I will see the goodness of the Lord in the land of the living. Wait for the Lord. Be strong and take courage and wait for the Lord." The key here, "I will see the goodness of the Lord in the land of the living." In other words, God is with David in the middle of all the danger, the pain, the loss, the fear. And because God is with him right in the middle of it, while it's happening, David makes up his mind to wait for the Lord. He will be strong, trust God, and take courage. David's voice for this? I imagine it's quieter than his opening exultant cry of confidence, and maybe quieter than when he cried out for help. It's quieter, steadier, and more resolved. He no longer anticipates automatic triumph. Maybe he will triumph. Maybe God will intervene in miraculous ways, and maybe God won't. But David trusts that God's goodness, God's love, God's eternal protection is happening right in the midst of life, right in the middle of all the things wonderful and awful that life hands us. God's goodness is right there all the time. No matter what. David's emotion? Not exultant. It's more sober and hopeful, and maybe even a feeling of wonder. Even in the worst circumstances, Lord, you are here. So what does David's story mean for us? I think it's wise to have a clear appreciation of the struggles and dangers of life. Don't deny them. Don't try to run away from them. And frankly, I am really good at that one. My anxieties can be enormous. But it's also important to intentionally, actively put ourselves in the house of the Lord, in a position where we can be with God, to be refreshed, to be reminded that we are more than a collection of water and chemicals. As Jeff said 2 weeks ago and Renee last week, the physical world is real. The spiritual world is even more real. Being in the presence of God, it's us being in that spiritual world even as we are in the physical world. It's like an oasis, a shelter, a place where our heads, drooping in discouragement or fear or shame or grief, are lifted up. Prayer, worship, remembering who we are and what is important. Being in the presence of God is like coming home. Sometimes God shows up in mystical, magical ways. We are moved and deeply touched. Not often, and we can't control it or make it happen. But when God shows up like that, it is really sweet. I think God did that for me when I was 11 and I saw the reality that God's eye is on the sparrow. And when fear of cancer forced me to see what really mattered. And sometimes when we open ourselves to be with God, we find that we are just with each other. But that too is an oasis, a homecoming. When we worship together, take communion, support each other, pray for one another, we are in the presence of God with each other. And together we can find refreshment, nourishment, a balm for our wounded, anxious spirits. And then we go back into the world because Jesus was in the world and God has placed us in the world to do good. Sometimes we are overcome with fear because fear is still a reasonable response. The dangers are still real. And that is when we have the option to choose faith over fear. It's a sober story, but actually, it is the most honest and hopeful story I can imagine. Fear reduces our lives and shrivels our humanity. Faith that God is with us in the midst of everything expands our lives and deepens our humanity. We can believe that we will see the goodness of God in the land of the living. I want to close with a really short story that's very dear to me, written in 1889 by George MacDonald. A young couple was caught in a flash flood, rising up to their waist, swirling fast around them. "I can't help being frightened," the girl gasped. "We are in God's arms," the boy answered. "He's holding us." "Are you sure we shall not be drowned?" she asks. "No," he says, "I'm not sure. But I am sure the water cannot take us out of God's arms." The goodness of God in the land of the living, in a time when chaos seems to surround us. So brothers and sisters, let us trust God and take courage together as we wait on the Lord. Amen.